This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio and streaming Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to start our show talking with Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a professor of philosophy at UND and the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which you will hear this Sunday at 5 Central right here on this Prairie Public Network. And Jack, this month your question is, does accepting the theory of evolution mean there is no meaning of life? Why did you pick this question?
I like the small, unimportant questions. I like the irrelevant things. You know, I came across this book about the topic, and I thought it was fascinating because evolution is such a bugaboo, if people still use that expression, a bugaboo in today's culture. Evolution has so many complicated meanings to it, right? Is it anti-religion? Is it the sign of scientific truth? But the ultimate question that I think we can ask after is it true is, what are the consequences of it? There are lots of people who think that if we are evolved from monkeys, as they will say, then life has no meaning and no purpose, and there's no right and wrong. And I don't know. As a philosopher, that doesn't sit well with me, and so I wanted to dive right in.
So why did you want to talk to Michael Roos about it? Michael is a professor and director of the History and Philosophy of Science program at Florida State University.
Michael is one of these guys who I can't believe exists. He's written over 50 books. He has this overall sense of history and science in particular and philosophy that is extraordinary. And so who else are you going to talk to about the meaning of life than someone who has a massively expansive view of the history of thought and ideas, and who can talk equally well about science? So it's not just, right, literature and philosophy and the great questions that we sort of relegate the meaning questions to, but it's also about the facts of the universe and scientific experimentation. And so I can't think of a better guest than Michael to engage in what may be among the hardest questions I've asked in the last 10 years.
I was really intrigued by the name of the program, though, and let's expand on that a bit. What is the purpose of a history and philosophy of science program?
Well, so people tend to think of science incorrectly, in my point of view, right? We think that science is only the latest conclusion. So eggs are bad for you. Okay, we won't eat them. Eggs are good for you. Okay, well, science was wrong. Eggs are sometimes bad for you, sometimes good for you. These people don't know anything, right? And that's how we think of science. We think of science as telling us facts that we can follow. But science has a history, and what makes science interesting is the debates and the discourses that travel throughout history to help us figure out not the truth, but the best truth we have so far, the most likely conclusion we have so far. And so when we talk about the history of and philosophy of science, we're talking about two different things. First, we're talking about the great minds like Copernicus and Isaac Newton who changed things along the way. But we're also talking about how we ask those questions. So one of the things, for example, that Michael and I talked about is that up until the Renaissance, the basic idea of the universe was that we thought of the world as an organism, as a living being. But then when people started inventing mechanical clocks, we changed the root metaphor to the universe as a machine, as a clockwork. Now, how you think about the universe is going to be really different. If you think of it as an organism, it's alive, it grows, it has its own meaning and its own purpose. If you think about it as a machine, it's just a tool, and we impose all of our meaning and value on it. When you talk about the history and philosophy of science, you get to talk about changes like that. And when you talk about changes like that, you get to see how and why we know the things that we do and how and why we don't know the things that we don't.
So is this ultimately a discussion about evolution versus creation with Dr. Roos?
It's not. It could have been that, and he has some discussion of Christianity in his book. But what it really becomes a discussion about is the meaning in our life and how we want to look for meaning in the systems. And there are two systems on the table. One is a system in which we are created by God, and God has a purpose for us, and God has a blueprint for us, and God declares what's good and what's not, and what's valuable and what's not. You can call that creationism, but it's certainly much more complex than that. And the other system on the table is the evolutionary system, where the system follows its own rules, where there is random mutation that lead to what Darwin called natural selection, or the creatures that survive the competition because they can live better in the world. And so since it's not just do you believe in creationism and do you believe in evolution, but since it's the supporting framework, that idea or theory that surrounds the claim of creation or the claim of evolution, then we get to have really interesting, subtle, and important conversations that are a lot more nuanced than what you hear the politicians arguing about or the talking heads argue about in the news programs.
Well, religions over the centuries have adapted to scientific findings. You mentioned Copernicus and others, and their findings have evolved over the centuries. So natural selection, Darwin's theory, came along with a belief in a designer. The designer can sort of throw the pieces out there and they can naturally select themselves, can't they?
Sure. Well, look, so there's nothing in Darwin, and Michael makes it very clear, there's nothing in Darwin that demands atheism, right? You can create a God, or you can have a belief in a God that creates an evolutionary system. That's not a problem. The reason why God disappears from the system is that there's no rhyme and reason to the progress. So originally, the early theories of evolution, and one example is a scientist named Lamarck, they thought that there was a principle that the universe was following, and each generation, so to speak, was closer to that goal. But it was all planned out in advance. And that's a God-driven system, or at least a principle-driven system. What Darwin does is say, we don't know what's going to happen in the next generation. What we do know is that there are scarce resources, that there are ways to survive, there are ways to reproduce that are better than others. And the creatures that go on to the next generation are the creatures that, by the accidents of mutation, by the accidents of birth, work better. Now, because it's an accident, because it's a scrambling around in the dark, because the conclusion is not established in advance, you don't have a God, or at least you don't need a God. And that leads us to ask, well, okay, then what is valuable, what is meaningful to us? If there is no God, how can I say that my life is better other than I survived, I reproduced? Even you can't even say I'm not in pain, because how do we know that pain isn't good, right? You're lost without that. And so what he wants to do is help us be unlost, if that's a word.
Okay. Well, if we follow our natural curiosity and our experimentation, and because of that we come across things we call discoveries, aren't we in effect boosting our own evolution? And doesn't that process, that curiosity and discovery, make us capable of things that we once thought were godlike?
It depends what you mean by evolution. If what you mean by evolution is that society progresses and we learn more things and we are incrementally better by some standard of better, then yes. But if what you're talking about is Darwinian natural selection, then first of all, human beings haven't really evolved in something like a million years. But more important than that, you can't force the changes. You can't force things. So let me give a simple example that we didn't talk about. About 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with a bulging disc in my lower back. It was very, very painful. I thought I was going to have surgery. Thankfully, I found other ways to deal with it. It turns out that this injury is the injury of truck drivers and secretaries, as the surgeon told me. And it's for people who sit all the time. Human beings are not designed to sit. If we had evolved over the last 1,000 years or even 200 years, then we would be creatures who would sit comfortably and our bodies would work well at desks, in cubicles, in cars and buses and trucks. But they don't, because we have the body of the Homo sapien. We have the body of the creature who hunters and gathers from 10,000 years ago. And so our body revolts, and my body hurts because I'm a professor and I sit a lot. If we could force evolution, we would make our kids' backs better because we sit in a desk. And we can't do that. All we can do is, in some instances, surgery. In my instance, Pilates. And you've never heard me say this, but I am an evangelical when it comes to Pilates. I can literally walk because of Pilates. And that has nothing to do with evolution, but it has to do with the creative intellectual ability to figure out how to deal with the world because our bodies won't evolve.
Well, I had the surgery, and so I'll be evangelical about that. But 10,000 years ago, a lot of things could kill you before you got to the age of 40. And by the time you got to the age of 40, old age might have killed you. So we have progressed beyond that.
We have progressed beyond that, and we are better off in society. But the same things can still kill us. We just know how to get rid of those same things. So have we evolved to be immune to measles? We have not. We have inoculations, right? Have we evolved to fly across the ocean and see the great works of art in the Louvre? No, we've invented airplanes. So Michael is not suggesting, and I'm not suggesting, that we don't get better, we don't get smarter, we don't get technologically more advanced. We aren't good at adapting to our world in that sense. But when we take the evolutionary perspective, none of that happens in a time frame that is going to be meaningful to any of us. It may be meaningful in a million years. Maybe in 100,000 years, we won't have bulging discs. I don't know. I can't say. But again, the consequence of this discussion is that if we can't do this, then is the meaning that we impose on ourselves, or the meaning that we find, is it just artificial because it's disconnected from nature, or is it artificial because it's disconnected from God? And so the question that Michael wants to ask is, can we recover a sense of the meaning of life and still accept what he regards as the truth, which is evolution as currently understood?
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. You'll hear it this Sunday at 5 Central on this radio network. And the question this month is, does accepting the theory of evolution mean there is no meaning of life? Jack, I looked up, as you mentioned, Michael Ruse is well-published. He's written a lot of stuff, and he's a well-known atheist. But he's at odds with other people who kind of share his rough belief, which he calls new atheists. What is a new atheist, and what distinction should we make from this?
So the new atheists are people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, who get a lot of attention, or Hitchens did when he was alive, get a lot of attention not only arguing for a scientific worldview, but also for really denigrating religion. Dawkins in particular is really nasty, and he has a very famous book, which I read and have a bunch of issues with, called The God Delusion. And he basically argues that religion and belief in God is not just false, but it's delusional. And what Michael wants to do is different than that. Michael is not at all interested in denigrating religion. He's not a believer, and he has arguments as to why he doesn't believe Christianity in particular, and there's some of that in the book. But he does believe that you can reconcile religion and science in ways that are meaningful and important. He doesn't want to say that the what he regards as false beliefs of religion should be regarded as superior or equal to the what he argues are the true claims of science. But he does think that religion gives people meaning, and he does think that religion is important, and he does think that it's a personal choice, and he does think that religion plays a tremendously important role in the history and philosophy of science and discovery. And so one of the things that I like about him is that while he is very opinionated and while he is very open about those opinions, he's not interested in belittling other approaches. He's only interested in trying to give a system that is going to make people feel satisfied with what they can hold on to and what's meaningful to them.
Well, Mr. Philosopher, is the fundamental difference between a believer's view and an atheist's view that when science is parsed to its finest, a mystery will remain that is unsolvable by a human.
You know, there are ineffable elements of the human experience. It may be the case that we never know all of the answers. There may be things that science can't explain. We don't know. We just have to keep trying, right? It's the same thing with the cure of cancer. We don't have a cure for cancer, but it doesn't mean we're not going to try. We don't have all the answers about the universe, about the nature of if there's an afterlife. We don't know these things. We have commitments. We have beliefs. We have insights. We have intuitions, but we don't know. What a philosopher does, what a scientist does, what pretty much anyone who is interested in inquiry, even if that inquiry takes the form of art or literature or music, says is we got to try. We got to figure it out. So I'm really reluctant to say we can't do anything. What I want to say is we try, we fail. We try, we fail. Maybe we get closer. Maybe we get closer. And maybe not my daughter or my grandchild or three generations, but maybe 5, 10, 20 generations, we will have deep, great answers, or maybe we won't. Maybe that unknowability is an important part of the human experience. I'm not sure, but I'm having a good career figuring it out.
Well, I have yet to see a circle of squirrels on the lawn having a Socratic discussion. So I'm thinking there is this, you know, miracle at this point to most of us about what it is that happens in our heads. We're thinking. We're asking questions. You're a philosopher. Your life is all questions. So is this uniquely human, what we're doing?
So I'm going to be a pain in the butt for a second and be a real philosopher here. So when you described human beings as having this what gets called metacognition, the ability to think about our own thinking, mm-hmm. you used the term miracle.
Yeah.
And what Michael Ruse is going to say and what others are going to say is – and actually famously David Hume in the 18th century said is – that's not a miracle. That's the most natural thing of all. It's evolutionary that we've developed this metacognition. A miracle is something that's outside of nature. A miracle is something that has no explanation. And we have explanations for a lot of these things, including the ability to think about our own thoughts. A couple years ago, we had an episode with Valerius Geist where he offered a evolutionary explanation for why people became artists. So the first part is it's not a miracle. But the second part is, yes, it appears that human beings are unique in that we appear to be the only animals who are able to have these thoughts about our own thinking, that we're the only animals who don't just live in the moment and don't just operate on certain kinds of instinct. Now, whether that's ultimately true or not remains to be seen. What has happened over the last 50 years in particular is that we've discovered that human beings aren't quite as different as we used to think. Philosophers used to think what makes an animal different from a human is that human beings can reason, animals can't, period. But now we know that dolphins, for example, engage in some sort of higher order reasoning. We know that chimpanzees engage in all sorts of social behaviors and rule following. We know that it's more of a spectrum rather than a black and white. But we do know, or as far as there is evidence, we are committed to the idea that humans are unique in this respect. And that means that the human experience is something different and worth exploring.
Okay. So philosophy is trying to always reconcile life with what does it all mean?
That's absolutely right. And sometimes it's in the background and we don't talk about it, but sometimes it's right in our faces. And that's what happened in this episode of Why. And it was fun and intense. And Michael is a jovial, as he reminded us, Englishman several times. And it's worth a listen because he's just a fun, funny guy who loves what he does. And his enthusiasm really came out in the conversation.
The question this month is, does accepting the theory of evolution mean there is no meaning of life? You can hear it this Sunday at 5 Central on Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein is the host. Thanks for being with us today, Jack.
Thank you, Doug. It's always a pleasure.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we speak to President Jefferson. We talk to him about the formation of the government of the United States.
And we hear from Mr. Jefferson the social compact theory that when you're alone, you're an absolute sovereign. When you join other people in a community, You have to negotiate what is for the Commonwealth and what part of your natural rights you get to keep unadjusted by government.
I did my best to talk to Mr. Jefferson about the great advantages Americans have today and pointed to he and his compatriots as the source of many of those.
But Jefferson, like all the founding fathers, worried that great comfort and luxury would put us to sleep and we would cease to be eternally vigilant, and that's when mischief, in the name of Alexander Hamilton, starts to creep in.
And of course you remind us that any nation who expects to be
ignorant and free expects what never has been and never can be in a state of civilization.
Join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Today at 11 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Gabe Brown. He joins us from our Bismarck studio. He's with Brown's Ranch, and he practices regenerative agriculture. Thanks for joining us, Gabe.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Let's get a definition, first of all. What is regenerative agriculture?
Most people have their own definition, so I will tell you mine. I don't think anyone has pinpointed anything concrete, but I think of regenerative agriculture as a renewal of food and farming systems which aims to regenerate our topsoils, increase biodiversity, improve the water, mineral, and nutrient cycle, all while increasing farm, ranch, and community profitability while ensuring an enjoyable quality of life for those taking part in it.
And you've written about it. You've written a book, Dirt to Soil, which I guess in three words is sort of what you're all about. How does this differ from what you used to do before you started these practices?
Yeah, so I was brought up in quote-unquote the conventional type mindset, one of tillage and monoculture grain production and set stock stocking rates with our livestock and pastures. And due to a series of events from 1995 through 1998, I lost four crops in a row to hail and drought, and I had to learn how could I be profitable without borrowing money, because after 4 years of not much income, the banker wasn't really willing to loan me any money. So I had to learn, okay, how does nature really work? How does soil function? How do ecosystems function? So the past 25 plus years, I've been on this journey of how we learn to focus on our natural resources, focus on working with nature instead of against her.
And this isn't a small plot of land we're talking about here. Describe Brown's Ranch.
So Brown's Ranch consists of approximately 5,000 acres just east of the city of Bismarck. And we have approximately 2,000 acres of cropland, another 2,000 acres of what we deem native prairie. In other words, to our knowledge, it's never been tilled. And then the other 1,000 acres was once cropland, and now we've ceded that back to perennials for grazing. We grow a wide variety of different cash crops, anything from corn and cereal rye and oats and barley and peas and hairy vetch and sunflowers, spring wheat. And then we also have a lot of livestock. We have a herd of cow-calf pairs. We raise grass-finished beef. We have a flock of ewes, and we raise grass-finished lamb. We have pastured pork. We have 1,400 laying hens out on pasture. We raise broilers. We have bees. We have a large vegetable garden, and we do some fruit production also.
You've got a 5,000-acre supermarket. That's a lot of diversity.
It is, and diversity is one of the tenets of regenerative agriculture. You know, so often in agriculture today, we see farmers only producing a small handful, maybe only two or three different crops. And we see livestock producers very specific, only producing beef or only producing dairy. And we think that the diversity lends itself well to long-term profitability because we have that diversity of income streams.
So does this take more people, more machinery? All this diversity would seem to require some additional assets.
You know, that's one thing that question I often get asked as I travel around, well, how many people does it take to do this? Well, realize that now my wife and I have turned the ranch over to our son because I spend the majority of my time traveling around trying to educate others as to regenerative agriculture. So that 5,000-acre ranch is run by my son. His girlfriend works for us full-time, and one hired man. That's okay. All.
Wow. That's pretty efficient. Well, tell us about the book, Dirt to Soil. What did you discover that you wanted to put in writing and share with others?
So I was asked by several different publishers to share my story of how we took a very degraded farm and through the series of events, those years of hail and drought, learned lessons that taught us how to convert very degraded soil into rich, very productive soil that will produce very profitable crops and livestock year in and year out without a lot of added input. So it's just simply the journey my family and I have been on the past 30-plus years.
Well, what have you learned? Is it this incredible diversity, changing, rotating crops in a much more extensive way than people typically do? Or are you putting stuff in? What are the other practices?
So what we've learned is there's six principles that are common no matter where in the world you are. And I travel all over the world teaching these principles. And I tell people it doesn't matter if I'm in Australia or Germany or the United States, I say I am 100% confident that the principles I share with them will work on their farm or ranch because these principles are uniform. So those principles are, number one is context. You have to farm and ranch in your context. I'll give you an example of that. In August, I was doing a series of workshops around Alberta, throughout Alberta, Canada. And they were trying to grow soybeans 300 miles north of the U.S. border. Well, that's out of context. In that growing environment, it's just not going to work. You know, it's not the right environment.
It's been tough this year in this environment.
That's right. And unfortunately, we've gotten to that in production agriculture where many are farming and ranching out of context. Another example would be calving in North Dakota in January or February. That's out of context with our environment. I used to do that for years, and now we calve in late May and June, and we calve out on grass, and the calves are healthy, the cows are healthy. It's absolutely a joy to calve. So that's the first principle is context. The second principle is that in nature, there's no mechanical disturbance and there's limited chemical disturbance. In other words, we don't have all this tillage going on and we don't put these copious amounts of chemicals. That doesn't occur in nature. Because of that, I had turned our farm over to 100% no-till in 1994. So we haven't tilled any of our soils for 25-plus years.
Wow.
The third principle is armor on the soil surface. Nature always tries to cover the soil with a living plant. And I tell people, you know, farmers who till, if that tillage is so good, why does something always try and grow there? In other words, you get weeds growing because nature wants to keep the soil covered so it's not prone to wind erosion, water erosion, evaporation, and so that is the third tenet. The fourth tenet is diversity. And you look in a native natural ecosystem, you always see diversity of plants, animals, insects. We don't see that in production agriculture today. You know, if I head east from Bismarck, I can drive a long way with seeing mostly only corn and soybeans. That's not how nature functions. That's not how soils function. The next principle is a living root in the soil as long as possible throughout the year. You know, nature functions this way. We see it in spring here on the northern plains when there's still snow on the ground. There's crocuses trying to reach up through that snow and bloom. nature always wants a living root. And the reason for that is that's how nutrients cycle. Plants take in CO2 out of the atmosphere. Photosynthesis occurs. They pump these root exudates, these carbon compounds, amino acids, sugars into the soil to attract microbiology in order to provide those plants with nutrients. That's how come we had these rich, deep prairie soils prior to European settlement, is because we had all these living plants as long as possible throughout the year. And finally, the sixth principle is animal and insect integration. Nature, natural ecosystems do not function without animals and insects. You look at production agriculture today, it's all about killing everything. You know, if there's a pest out there, we want to kill that pest. Well, entomologists tell me that there's 1,700 beneficial species for every pest insect species. Well, why do we spend all of our time trying to kill that pest? Instead, we should be spending our time providing the home and habitat for all the beneficials that would eat that pest. And that's what we've done on our ranch. We haven't sprayed an insecticide since sometime in the late 1990s. There's no need to, because we provide the home and habitat for all the beneficials. And then by using the livestock that we have as a tool to graze cover crops on our cropland, we're cycling nutrients and we're benefiting the soil resource that way. So these six principles, Doug, are what we've applied on our ranch, and I'm happy to say there's farmers and ranchers on every continent using these principles to restore their ecosystems as well.
What about those farmers and ranchers who surround the Brown Ranch?
Well, the beautiful thing about that is, and I tell people, I think when I went no-till in 1994, I was the first 100% no-tiller in Burley County, North Dakota. Now, the vast majority of cropland acres in Burley County are no-tilled. Also, we started a grazing system by moving our livestock, and we move our livestock on a daily basis during the growing season. Now, the majority of ranchers in Burley County are also moving their livestock. Maybe not daily, but they do have a planned grazing system. So these practices have caught on.
Your regenerative ag practices, the fact that you don't use chemicals and you limit tillage and all that kind of thing, how does this differ from like organic farming? Do you have a particular market for your produce that is unique?
So my son has developed a business called Nourished by Nature, and that he has that label trademarked, and then he markets all of our products, whether it be, you know, the beef, the lamb, the pork, the eggs, the honey, all under that Nourished by Nature label. And he sells directly to consumers throughout North Dakota. Last time I asked him, he told me he was over 8,000 customers in North Dakota are buying his Nourished by Nature products now. As far as how does that differ from organic, and I want to make this clear. We still do occasionally use a herbicide, but it's very, very seldom. As a matter of fact, in 2018, our total herbicide bill for our 5,000-acre ranch was $19.95. So it's very, very minute amount. The vast majority of our cropland acres, we have not used any chemicals for the past 7 years on them. The difference between us and most organic operations is that we no-till. We do not till at all. And see, when you're tilling the soil, and the same thing happens in a garden. I speak to a lot of gardeners, too, and they go out and they till their garden. That's absolutely the worst thing you could do, not only for the health of the soil. You know, there's more microorganisms in a teaspoonful of healthy soil than there are people on this planet. Well, think about that. Yet, what are we doing by tilling? We're destroying their home. If we don't provide a home for biology, how are those plants going to get nutrients? If those plants don't get the nutrients they need, how are the animals who consume those plants, or us as humans, how are we going to get the nutrients that we need? I was being interviewed on a radio talk show that a doctor has in Boston. And we talked about the soil health to human health connection. And what really drives human health is all – they're called these plant secondary metabolites and tertiary compounds. They're these nutrients that plants get from the biology. Well, in today's production model, with heavy tillage, monoculture production, and the lack of diversity, lack of biology, being able to transfer these nutrients, it's having a direct negative impact on human health. You know, the United States spends more on healthcare than any other country in the world, yet we rank first in cancer, ADD, ADHD, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, autoimmune diseases, obesity, osteoporosis, and the list goes on. Well, you know, there's something going on here. And we need to realize, are farmers and ranchers to blame for all that? No. But we have to realize that we are to blame for part of that.
Gabe Brown is with Brown's Ranch, which is east of Bismarck, and he's an advocate for regenerative agriculture practices. And Gabe, I came across a big article that was headlined, "Can Regenerative Agriculture Reverse Climate Change? Big Food is Banking on It." This was created by an organization called Civil Eats. And I'm going to read you one sentence in this. General Mills, the packaged food giant, is one of several big food corporations jumping on the regenerative agriculture bandwagon, escalating the buzz around the idea that capturing carbon in the soil could reverse climate change. So there's another potential benefit to this practice?
Regenerative agriculture is the one thing out there that has the ability to bring many facets of society together. Yes, due to the biodiversity and living root in the soil as long as possible, we're going to be able to take more carbon out of the atmosphere, put it back into the soil, into the cycle, to feed biology. That's where it belongs. So it can certainly address that. Regenerative agriculture has the ability to advance our water cycle. You know, look at the flooding that happened all up and down the Mississippi this past spring through the Central Plains here. Well, think of what we've done to our water cycle. And I'll use my ranch as an example. When my wife and I purchased our ranch in 1991 from her parents, I could only infiltrate a half of an inch of rainfall per hour. Well, now I can infiltrate an inch in 9 seconds and a second inch in 16 seconds.
Wow.
We can infiltrate well over 30 inches per hour. Okay, one of the reasons we're seeing this flooding that we saw last spring is simply because we've destroyed the water cycle. We've destroyed the aggregation in the soil, the ability of that soil to infiltrate water, move it throughout the soil profile, and then via the amount of carbon in that soil to hold it there. You know, we went through the years 2016, 2017, 2018 were very, very dry here in central North Dakota. Yet our ranch went through those dry years without any problems, issues at all, because we're able to hold so much more water in our soil. It makes us very, very resilient to these swings in temperature and moisture. So that article is correct. We do have the ability to store more carbon. We have the ability to improve the water cycle. And along with that then means we have less problems with nitrates in the water, the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, the phosphates that are showing up in the Great Lakes. And then the third thing is it gets back to food that is higher in nutrient density that'll have a positive impact on human health. So regenerative agriculture can bring all of these facets of society together. And I tell people, why don't we come together and work on the 80% of the things we agree on, and the rest of it will sort itself out over time.
Well, General Mills is doing pilot projects. The first one spans 50,000 acres, and it started this spring with 45 oat farmers in our state, North Dakota, and Canada. A second pilot program starts in November in Kansas, and is that where you're going to be training people?
That's exactly right. We were fortunate that General Mills sought out Understanding Ag, which is the company that my business partners and I founded to work with those 45 oat producers on that pilot project. That project will actually be expanded this year. We're going to increase the number of producers and also bring in some producers in Minnesota. And then we're going to roll out the pilot project for wheat producers in Kansas.
Wow. So is the state's Ag Department interested in your enterprise, NDSU Ag Extension?
Well, I would like to think that they're watching, put it that way.
Because this is getting to be a very big deal.
Well, it is, and it affects all facets. You know, right now there's a real crisis occurring in agriculture. Profitability is extremely low. And to draw attention to the fact of what the financial industry is thinking of regenerative agriculture, our business, Understanding Ag, has been hired by several financial institutions to put on trainings for their farm borrowers because they're seeing that the most profitable clients of theirs are those that are practicing regenerative agriculture. So I think that this is regenerative agriculture is how we are going to, as farmers and ranchers, become much more profitable. I do want to mention it too, and I'm not mentioning this to brag, but I want to bring up a point. You know, we're what, approaching $22 trillion in debt in this country? Well, my partners and I and the field consultants that work for us, we do not accept any government program payments anymore. We do not take part in crop insurance, CSP, EQIP contracts, none of that. Because we are profitable without that. Now, don't get me wrong. I want to be clear about this. I did take part in those programs for years. But as I went down the regenerative path, I found out that those programs, those government programs, are actually antagonistic to me moving my ranch to a regenerative model.
Well, this is a rich vein of discussion, Gabe. Gabe Brown is with Brown's Ranch. He's an advocate for regenerative agriculture practices, and he has an enterprise called Understanding Ag. Thank you very much for sharing some time with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Doug.
NPR One is all about you. Hand-picked public radio content based on what you like.
Who knew?
NPR One connects you to a stream of public radio news, stories, and podcasts curated especially for you.
NPR Hourly Newscasts, Prairie Public Regional News, it's all there.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
Download NPR One in the App Store now and select Prairie Public as your station.
Or Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
A world of customized content delivered right to your smartphone.
Okay, guys, headphones on.
The story puts you in the center of the action.
It's on whenever you're on.
NPR One is all about you.
Download it today.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Throughout history, humans have developed processes to extend the life and quality of food. For example, we dehydrate and freeze food. Other methods are more complex, like pressure canning and fermentation. And when it comes to canning, you need to know what foods are okay in a water bath and what foods need to be pressure canned to stay safe. Rita Usadas with NDSU Extension recently spoke at First Fridays at B, a monthly discussion about safe, healthy, sustainable food systems, where she addressed common myths about canning.
First of all, fact or myth, old church books or your grandma's cookbooks have great canning recipes you'll want to use. Myth. Old church cookbooks or your grandma's cookbooks provide outdated and unsafe, very unsafe canning methods. Hear that? Very unsafe. And so in the late 80s, early 90s, food preservation was hot, was really hot. And then it's kind of died off. And now in the last about 6 years, it's coming really hot again. And I think this because you guys want to know where your food's coming from and preserve your own food. Well, the research actually began in 1940s with the USDA, and that's the United States Department of Agriculture. The first publication that was ever written was in 1909. That was before Extension. So if you have any information in your house, like a Ball Blue book or Extension publications, and they have anything before 2006, throw them away or donate them to the museum. So only use recipes from USDA, extension, or ball. And you don't have to use NDSU extension. We would like that because that's formulated for our area. But you can go on any website and do research-based canning recipes. So you might get something from Alaska or Georgia, or Ball Blue Book is another one. Fact or myth, as long as you boil the jars of vegetables long enough, you have a safe product. Here's a little bit about botulism. 1 milligram of pure botulism toxin can kill 655 tons of mice. Food can contain botulism. It would have no signs or smells or taste to it. There's an antioxidant available if you catch it soon enough, but you might have some permanent nerve damage. Well, why do you really care? Well, it happened in North Dakota, and I know it was in 1931, and that was a long, long time ago. But it was in a county where I actually served for about 9 years. And so it was very popular up in Grafton. 12 people died from eating pasta salad with peas that weren't processed right. How would you like to have that in your family reunion? Well, you say that's 1931. Who really cares? Well, you know what? It happened in 2017 in Ohio at a potluck at a church. One person died, 18 people got sick, 21 people were also monitored. They traced it back to a potato salad that was made with potatoes that weren't processed right. They weren't pressure canned, they were just hot water bath. That's why I don't eat at potlucks. Well, we don't want you to be afraid. Safe food preservation at home is very possible. Fact or myth? Vegetables, meats, and most mixtures of food should only be canned in a pressure canner. It's a fact. We actually look at the acidity of the food to determine how we can can it. So any food that has a low pH, 4.6 or lower, has to be pressure canned, except when you acidify them. Meats, poultry, seafood, soups, and mixtures of low acid foods. Don't confuse a pressure canner and a pressure cooker. This is one of my favorite calls I get every year in the office. You have to have a pressure canner, and it has to be big enough to hold 4-quart-sized jars. The other one I get a lot of, because there's an electric pressure canner out there right now, we still don't recommend that. There's not enough research out there to support that we can say, yep, it's safe. Fact or myth? Canning in your oven is safe, convenient way to seal jars. This is the latest internet craze. So canning in the oven is not safe. I got to tell a gentleman that he had to throw 275 quarts of food away because he canned them in his oven. He said, Rita, do you know how long that took me to do? I said, yep. I said, do you want to kill off your wife or your children, your friends? The methods are extremely dangerous for low acid foods. Don't use any other appliances either. We've had some that are trying microwave cooking. Right now, the dishwasher is the really popular one. Another factor miss. You can invent your own salsa recipe as long as you process it in a water bath canner. That's a myth. You can prevent your own recipe, but you just have to freeze it. You need to follow the formulas exactly, measure and weigh ingredients carefully. So enjoy food preservation. Make sure you use up-to-date current recipes. If you have questions, call your local extension agent.
That was Rita Usadas with NDSU Extension speaking at First Fridays at B, a monthly meetup about food in Moorhead. And another way to preserve food is to pickle it. Kevin Struxness runs the Hairy Hippie Pickling Company, and he spoke at First Fridays at B on the art of pickling for preservation.
It all started really young. My grandma, my mom, my aunts, they all taught us at an early age to not ever waste food, right? So how Hairy Hippie Pickling Company came to be, though, was I was at a barbecue, brought a dozen jars of pickles with, and they were gone in maybe 20 minutes. And everybody said, we need more of these. We need more of these. And I just happened to have a few hundred sitting at home. The year before, I had maybe 12 cucumber plants, and they just kept producing and producing. So you think to yourself, it's like, what am I going to do with all this? So Hairy Hippie Pickling was born. And now we have, I think, 16 recipes. I can't remember. We try to specialize in canning food that we grew ourselves. Now, this past year, we've gone out to some farmers. I see a couple in here that I've purchased produce from. So now we can claim that everything in our jars has been grown locally, which is important to us. You know, the people that we sell to, it's important to them as well to know where their food is coming from. We took our grandma's recipe and basically made it into something that's safe in 2019. So a lot of the flavors are going to be the same. The produce is the same, but now we're not going to die of botulism, which is, I think, the main goal. We knew we were great at making pickles. What we didn't know is that we were great at growing weeds. I think with starting any business, you're going to have some hiccups along the way, and you're going to learn and grow from it. We were still able to can over 2,000 jars that summer, on top of asking anybody and everybody if they like to pull weeds. I've got a spot for you. So cucumbers, you can see a lot of different sizes, right? If you go to Gedney or Clausen, it's all going to be the same. Everyone is, you know, 4 inches, 4.5 inches, perfect height, width. We're not interested in that. We like imperfection of at-home canning. There's one that you might have to cut in half. There's one that you might just throw in there after you take the flower off. And it, in the long run, it doesn't matter to us as long as the flavor is there in the end. Because if it's small, large, medium, sliced, cubed, whatever, doesn't matter. We can everything in our house. Now, we follow all the Minnesota cottage law. So essentially it's, you know, wearing gloves and wearing a hairnet and making sure everything is sterilized. It's really interesting how those rules change from year to year, but in the long run, you know, you just put a label on made in an at-home kitchen, and as long as you're following some certain guidelines, that you're going to be okay. Please enjoy pickles.
That was Kevin Struxness of the Hairy Hippie Pickling Company speaking at First Fridays at B, a monthly meetup about food that's sponsored by Food of the North and the Cass Clay Food Partners.
Listen to our podcast or a previous broadcast anytime, anywhere. In your home or on your phone, you can catch Main Street on any street. All day, all night, a friend in Fiji or your aunt in Vermont can tune into a show you just know they'd want to hear, or they can browse older shows for other topics of interest. Our app and archives are easy to find. They're right on Main Street, in the radio neighborhood at prairiepublic.org.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.